Man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny.
We can't really think that the government, to whom we pay taxes and who is for security, has anything to do with the terrorist who creates insecurity and chaos and fear. But in Italy and in other countries, we find that in some specific cases, criminal elements of the government are linked to this strategy of tension. And that strategy is to create fear in the population, to shock people. But then in the end, you pay your taxes to a government which uses the money to finance terrorism. We know that acts of terrorism were carried out, and we know that many people, including in Turkey and in Italy, who were involved in these acts of terrorism, say the Americans and the British covered us. They wanted us to carry out these acts of terrorism, but it's very difficult to prove.
The military regimes we install, they are not answerable to the presidents or the kings that we have installed. They are answerable to the United States. As simple as that. So you're looking at the Clinton administration and Bush administration. You're looking at a Democrat and you're looking at a Republican. So it's not partisan. It doesn't go only to two evils, Cheney and Bush. One of the biggest reasons I believe a lot of people don't get it and don't want to get it, and this is in the United States. With most of our foreign viewers, that doesn't seem to be the case as much, but especially with the United States, is we are conditioned to look at things as very classic black hat guys and the guys in white hats, okay? Now, you get these guys in black hats versus other guys in black hats, it just doesn't go through.
You're listening to episode 692 of Unwelcome Guests. The European Deep State, post-World War II. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard some collected thoughts from Professor Daniele Ganza, Swiss historian, whose specialist subject is NATO's stay-behind armies, the secret networks which came to be known as Operation Gladio, and from FBI whistleblower Sibel Edmonds on false flag terrorism and the maneuvers being carried out in the 21st century to obscure its real perpetrators. We have about 80 minutes from Daniele Ganza, who introduces Gladio, and then most of the rest is Sibel Edmonds, and we have a short report on the Ergenekon cases in Turkey, which I'd heard nothing about until researching this topic. So, what was Gladio? What is Gladio? A secret organization set up in about 1948 by NATO or the intelligence agencies. The CIA and MI6 repeatedly come up as those in control, and nominally this was to resist, in the case of a communist invasion, to act as a terrorist fifth column to thwart a Soviet occupation. But this is contradicted by the fact that the groups have been active in spite of no invasion from the Soviets. So there's clearly more to it than that. What do we know about this network? Well, as Daniele Ganza noted, it is difficult to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt. If the forces of the state are officially denying and lying about what's going on, what kind of evidence can we expect? Well, we have a network which has been in existence, training people to commit acts of terrorism, arranging for secret caches of weapons, bombs, armaments, and doing so not under the oversight of national political leaders, not under the oversight, more or less, of the heads of armies in these supposedly independent nation states, but under its own auspices, or is it personal connections, or is it the NATO command structure, Well, we don't exactly know. What we do know is that they did carry out terrorist attacks against Western European populations, and that's how, after 40-plus years of total secrecy, Operation Gladio, as it came to be known because it's called after the Italian section, all these national groups had different names, and when this became known that they'd carried out these attacks, was the whole operation rolled up and people put in jail? Well, people were put in jail, but the operation did not cease. The European Union carried out some kind of investigation and said, we need real investigations carried out by the national governments involved, which is almost all the Western European states and a few others in Europe. And how many of these investigations took place? Well, to date, I think only 3 countries have carried out any sort of investigation. So what does this tell us about the power of the network? Well, the BBC did produce a film on Gladio. It's disappeared down the memory hole of late, but of course it's available on YouTube, so if you want to look for it, it's in the Time Watch series. If you look up under Time Watch and Gladio, I suspect you can find it. But how much reporting have we heard about Gladio of late? Has CBS, ABC, have any of the American networks said anything about it? Well, these have been provably carried out, these false flag attacks. So how has this basically been swept under the carpet? Well, it would seem that the commercially controlled media have been directed not to go near this topic. National political leaders of supposedly independent countries also don't seem to want to go near this topic. Is this somehow connected to political assassinations which were carried out in Europe? Think about Olof Palme, Aldo Moro, other such political figures who, if we believe the official narrative, were killed by a range of lone nuts. Well, I see a parallel here. In America, we had a range of political assassinations, as the cabal that carried out the JFK assassination basically took control of the established political machinery. In Europe, I think it's been a more complex operation. We have a lot of different nation states, different national structures, languages, cultures. I should think it would have been harder to have brought that under a single unified control, and I don't know if it is under single unified control. What we know is that the nation states of Europe seem remarkably uniform in their refusal to investigate this. One might think this should be a high priority. Your country has been infiltrated by a network of terrorists with a track record of carrying out false flag attacks. So is this a priority to investigate? The fact that Gladio has been basically off the radar should tell us something about what's going on. It apparently transcends national governments. It's obsessively secret. The involvement of top intelligence agency operatives. This appears to me to have all the hallmarks of a deep state operation. So why did a small number of people in about 1948 say, let's set up a network which can carry out terrorist attacks, which maintain plausible deniability, which are well-funded and trained, have minimal chance of getting caught. Let's set that up and let's not tell anybody about it. Let's not bother to inform national political leaders. Well, hard to know exactly what their motives were. As we heard in the introduction, we are conditioned to think of national governments as protecting us. They are the good guys fighting the bad guys. And these simplistic narratives appeal to us, given all the programming we've seen. How many war films did you see where it was the good guys against the bad guys? This is a very common motif. This underlies the idea of the just war, and so on. This appears to me to be a crucial element in the establishing of the European deep state, like the American deep state, which until recently was completely off the radar. I hope the overview is clear now. I hope the following facts from Daniela Ganser will help us to understand why the commercial media is not talking about Gladio at all, which is talking instead about these supposed fanatical Muslim extremists. The interview is from May 2010.
I'm going to ask you a group of questions. The first are going to be about Gladio in general, mm-hmm. and the history and so on. And then I want to talk about Gladio in Spain, about your chapter mm-hmm. of Gladio in Spain. So maybe we can talk first about the general things about Gladio in Europe. And so what is Gladio? What's the definition of Gladio? And what are the secret armies of the NATO?
So the word Gladio is actually used as a name for the Italian secret army, which operated in Italy during the Cold War. Gladio was discovered in 1990, first time in Italy, and then Italian members of the secret army said that similar secret armies existed in all countries of Western Europe. The Italian Prime Minister, Giulio Andreotti, at the time explained that the name Gladio was secret for a long time. Nobody knew about it. And it was the name for a stay-behind army, which meant it was a network of soldiers who waited for a Soviet invasion. That was one of the main ideas. And the other thing was that they tried to manipulate the Italian political system in the absence of a Soviet invasion.
I would like to know if it was financed by the CIA or uncoordinated by NATO. Where did the money came from?
Well, the idea for the network was an American and a British idea. Washington and London at the beginning of the Cold War were scared that in Western Europe, communist parties or at some times socialist parties would come to power. And in Italy, we had very strong communist parties. And in France, we also had strong communist parties. And so they set up these networks. And so the money in the beginning came from the CIA, the American Central Intelligence Agency, which is the Foreign Secret Service of the US. And much of the training came from the British, the MI6, the British Foreign Secret Service. So really, it was the CIA and the MI6 together working in Italy, and instructing the secret soldiers of the Gladio units. The coordination of the stay-behind armies was managed through NATO. So we had a secret branch within NATO, which was called the Allied Clandestine Committee, ACC. And in this ACC, the representatives of the Gladio in Italy, people from the CIA, people from the MI6, but also from all the other NATO countries, thus from Norway or Denmark or France or Germany, they met and sat together to discuss what to do with the secret armies.
So how did the secret soldiers receive orders? There were hierarchical direct orders, or there was freedom of action?
There was a hierarchical structure because in Italy, for instance, you have the defense ministry, and within the defense ministry, you have the military secret service. And within the military secret service, there was a sub-branch, which is that Gladio branch. So it was really integrated as a secret element within the military secret service. It was not part of the army. It was part of the military secret service, but in the sense that people who were working in these networks, they were private people. They didn't consider themselves to be working for the state. Some, and that is the delicate thing, were from the extreme right-wing groups like Avanguardia Nazionale or Ordine Nuovo. These people in Italy were fascists convinced that they had to fight communism because they thought the communists are atheists, and they hated the atheists very much. They were devout Catholics, and they didn't want that the communists come into power. So these people were supported by the United States and by Great Britain in order to keep that delicate balance of power in Italy and in other countries in such a way that the left would not gain too much influence.
So you mean that there were two different kind of Gladio soldiers, like two groups of Gladio soldiers, like the ones that were prepared to act in a possible USSR invasion, and others that were terrorists, fascists.
That is the delicate thing, you know. That is really the most complicated question to answer. It is true. All of these secret soldiers say, we just waited for the Soviet invasion. That is not a criminal thing to do. I mean, these people just thought, in case Italy or France or Germany or Switzerland or Greece, in case any of these countries is going to be occupied, okay, then we come into action. We don't do anything if there's no invasion. So that is a first group, that is correct. But then there's another group, and that is also correct, which was more interested to fight the political fight in the country. There is a general, an Italian general, who commanded the Gladio network in the 1970s, and his name is Gerardo Serravalle. And he explains in a book that when the CIA came to the training center, they had a training center on an island off the Italian coast, and the gladiators were trained there. And then when the CIA came, the general Serravalle explained to the CIA, you know, we have arms caches in hidden places, so in case of the Soviet invasion, we're ready and everything. And then he explains that the CIA was not so interested in their preparations for a Soviet invasion. They were much more interested, he says, in what they can do to influence the Italian political system. So in case there were large protest movements, what they could break a protest movement, or what they could carry out destabilization operations. And that is a very delicate thing with the NATO secret armies, because we now know that some members of the Italian right wing, they came forward and they said, yes, this secret network existed, and yes, I knew of it, and I cooperated with it, and I carried out terrorist attacks, which were then blamed on the communists or on the other groups on the left. And this helped to destabilize Italy. Vincenzo Vinciguerra is there the most important source. He then went to jail, but in jail he explained, you know, NATO covered us. We could carry out terrorist attacks in Italy, and then we were flown, some of us, to Spain during the Franco dictatorship. That was a safe haven, and then we were flown to another country. So it's a very delicate thing.
For example, after I will ask you about the Italian fascist terrorists that came to Spain, but for example, Ali Acca, the person that tried to kill John Paul II, I think you, in your book, in your chapter about Turkey, you talk also about his organization. Was he, can we say that he was also a stay behind soldier?
In Turkey, we have, also a group of people who belong to the Grey Wolves, which was a very nationalist and sometimes militant part of Turkish establishment. And these people, some of them worked in the stay behind networks. But it is very difficult to say, this person we know for sure was a member of the Turkish secret army, and this person is just a freelance terrorist. I mean, that is very difficult to say, because we don't have the lists of all the people who worked in the secret armies. The military secret services only confirmed, yes, we had secret armies. Yes, they were equipped with explosives. Yes, they were equipped with weapons. Yes, they were trained by the CIA. Yes, they were trained by MI6. Yes, they were linked to NATO, and NATO was in command. But whenever we try, as historians, to talk to NATO and tell them, we need documents, were these people involved in terrorism? When we try to talk to the CIA and say, we need more documents, were you linked to acts of terrorism in Europe? I mean, then the CIA said, we're not going to comment. And NATO says the same thing, we're not going to comment. Because it is still today unspeakable almost to say that there was CIA-linked terrorism in Europe. So it is ongoing research. We know that acts of terrorism were carried out, and we know that many people, including in Turkey and in Italy, who were involved in these acts of terrorism, say the Americans and the British covered us. They wanted us to carry out these acts of terrorism, but it's very difficult to prove.
I'm very interested in the economic part of Gladio. I know there is not much information, but for example, in Italy, the Gladio network had something to do with the Vatican Bank, the IOR, and the Ambrosiano, and so on, and the money of the mafia.
This I don't know for sure. It is unclear how the money flows were organized. What we do know is that in one case, the Italian secret soldiers, the gladiators in Italy, they said, well, you know, the Americans, they give us the weapons for free. And the British, if we buy the weapons from the British, then we have to pay. And then there was a debate within the defense ministry in Italy, whether they should take the weapons from the Americans, from the CIA, or from the British, from the MI6. And then the military professionals said, well, it's actually better to work together with the British because they have a better training. And what they did in the end is that they went to the British, took the training from the British, and at the same time took the weapons from the CIA for free. And in fact, when the British found out, they were very angry because, you know, they wanted to sell their weapons as well. Now, the whole structure of financial flows into Italy during the Cold War is very complicated. Banco Ambrosiano, many other structures, they had black money throwing through their accounts. And whether some of this black money was used to support the secret armies is possible, but we don't know.
Have you studied the links between some gladio soldiers or people like Licio Gelli or Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi, with the Order of Malta? Is there? Have you studied that, or is there any more links?
What I looked at is like people like Licio Gelli. I looked at these people in more detail. Licio Gelli was obviously a right-wing extremist in the Italian Cold War, and he was convinced that the Cold War was a war. You know, he didn't consider it to be peacetime. He thought we are at war with the Italian communists. And so he was actually paid a lot of money by the United States to make sure that the influence of the Italian right-wing groups were strong in Italy. And Gelli made this statement that, you know, thanks to Gladio, Italy didn't become a zone of communist influence. So he was proud, and he said, we had a lot of influence behind the scenes, obviously in public, people would say Italy is a sovereign country and is a democratic country. But he says that was not true. We were neither democratic nor sovereign because we had a parallel structure, in this case, the Propaganda Due, which was a network of people who were from the parliament, who were from the executive, who were leading industrialists, who were bankers, and who also were judges or police officers or military officers. And they're all cooperated behind the scenes. And that is not the idea of democratic checks and balances. In a democracy, you actually have the parliament which controls the executive. Okay? And if something goes wrong, you have the judge who says, you know, it's not all right. But in Italy, with the Propaganda Due and with Gladio, we had parallel structures who operated behind the lines. And Licio Gelli was always invited to the United States when a new president came into office, such when in 1981 Ronald Reagan became the new president of the United States. Licio Gelli was there. He was invited because he was an important person from the globe. And the same in Germany. If you look at Reinhard Gehlen, whom you mentioned, he was a general who worked for Hitler during the Second World War. And many people think that at the end of the Second World War, all the generals who worked for Hitler went to the Nuremberg trials. You know, they went directly to jail. And that's not true. Some did, but others were flown to Washington because they were useful. Okay, the Counterintelligence Corps, which is an American secret service, they recruited some of the Nazis and said, now, why don't you run secret operations for us in Germany? You are useful. And Reinhard Gehlen, he was the chief of Fremde Heere Ost. He was then the first commander of the first German secret service, which was called Organisation Gehlen. That's quite embarrassing, you know, that actually a general from Hitler was the first commander of the first German secret service. But under these circumstances, the stay-behind armies and the secret structures could be set up also in Germany. When I say Germany, I mean obviously the part controlled by Washington and not the part controlled by Moscow.
And do you think they really feared a USSR invasion, or what did they fear the most? The Soviet dictatorship, or that their multinational companies could not have access to cheap labor salaries, for example? I mean, because maybe it was, I think it was an excuse, the USSR invasion, because as you said, they didn't want the communist parties to be in power, but also not just the communist parties, but also the working class movement, I think. Because why did they fear so much the USSR? And by the other way, they were going to China. Nixon was going to China, and China was also a communist dictatorship. So I don't understand that very well.
Well, this is a question which comes up many times for historians. If you look at the Cold War, you can ask, why was the CIA fighting the communists? Why was the MI6 fighting the communists? So what was the problem? And obviously one side of the problem was that people hate the communists. They thought they have totalitarian structures. There was no voting right, for instance, in Romania and Bulgaria. You know, there was just the communist party. You could not vote. You could not, you know, meet where you wanted. You had secret services coming and arrest you. Under Stalin, for instance, the Soviet Union was a totalitarian system. So some people in the CIA and some people in MI6, they were especially worried about these things. And that's why they said, we fought for freedom, in the sense of we fought for a good thing. We tried to liberate people from communist oppression. Now, that is one story, and it's true. But there is another story, which is also true. In some countries, we had democratically elected presidents. Like in Chile, for instance, we had Salvador Allende. He was democratically elected, and he tried, you know, to give more money to the people in Chile and to become more independent of the United States. Now, he was overthrown in 1973 by the CIA, and Pinochet was installed, who was a brutal dictator. So people go like, we thought you fight against dictators. We thought you fight against, you know, the oppression of people. But in this case, you actually installed a dictator. Why did you do that? I mean, it doesn't make sense if it really is true that you fight for freedom. And then you see that the CIA, in some cases, is not interested in fighting for freedom at all, but is interested in securing economic privileges. That's what you say. You know, you say, what is it if we think about the money? What is it? Is it actually the money? Why they do all these things? You know, that big companies have bigger profits. And there is obviously a lot of examples. In Guatemala, for instance, you had United Fruit Company, if you want a concrete example of a company. And United Fruit Company, today called Chiquita, they produced bananas and other fruit in Guatemala. And they produced this very cheaply. And the farmers, they were exploited. They belonged to big haciendas, and they had no rights, okay? They had no salary, or just very, very small salary. And then a new government came in, Arbenz, Jacobo Arbenz, and he said, now let's change this economic structure. It is not fair and it is not right. We should give every farmer a bit of land so he can have a little income. You know, just a very little income. He could not get rich. It would just be a little bit for him and his family. But that obviously meant that the big companies would lose their big land. And that was not acceptable. So the CIA came in and they overthrew the government of Guatemala in 1954. Obviously, that was against democracy, but it was for international companies. And now the question comes, how about Europe? Was that the same? It is obviously something which applied also to Europe. Americans and the British were scared that the labor movement would be very strong. And that labor unions, as you had them in France and as you had them in Italy and also in Belgium, would actually, you know, dominate the whole economic discourse. In the end, Europe was much more lucky than Latin America, because most countries managed to have good salaries for their people, to have social welfare plans. I mean, all these things that we have today in Europe, people fought for them. Voting rights for women, freedom of press, you know, this obviously with limitations. So it is true what you say, this fight for money is always part of the picture.
Yes, because maybe that's the only information that I would like to have more. Maybe in your next book about Gladio, you can study this. Because it can seem strange that the U.S. government was fighting against the Nazis in the Second World War, but after they were hiring some of them, Klaus Barbie and Skorzeny or Reinhard Gehlen, and they were protecting them and hiring them for their own interests. So this makes me think that we should not think so much in terms of nations, but of oligarchic power of some multinational companies. Because, as I said before, there's no problem with China right now, and it's a dictatorship. So the problem is not the dictatorship, but the problem is that the thing is that if you can invest or not in that country. If it's a dictatorship, but it lets you have your companies there and you can have your companies in that country, there's no problem. But if it's a dictatorship that doesn't want those companies to be there, then there is a problem, and then you have to change. They have to change the government. I don't know if I'm wrong.
This is obviously something which many people are interested in. You know, it's the debate about the free market. Basically, what people say is the free market means everybody can invest everywhere in the world, and you know, the best products will be then generated, and everybody everywhere in the world will get richer and will have a better life. That is the theory. Okay. But obviously we see that in reality, it very often is the case that some countries are poor and they have a lot of debts and they just have to pay interest on their debts all the time. Their people don't have any education. They can't go to school. They can't even read, and they have no chance to get, you know, build a strong middle class. And you just have a very, very small oligarchy, as you called it. And that is the correct term. It just means that you have an upper class of millionaires. For instance, in Angola, if you want, Angola is an interesting country. They have a lot of oil. It's all offshore. But Angola has a millionaire class. These people are very, very rich. They rule the country. They used to be communists, but, you know, it doesn't matter. They now became very rich. And the rest of the country is very poor. And what you say is correct, that as long as it's possible to invest in these countries, the government can stay in place. But to take a new example, if you take the Iraq war, which started in 2003, I mean, Saddam Hussein obviously was a dictator, and he was a brutal dictator. He tortured his people, he used weapons of mass destruction. He really used them against his people. Later he didn't have them anymore, but he was an evil dictator. Only he was supported. He was supported by Washington. He was supported by European governments during the 1980s. Now, in the 90s, they changed their mind. And in 2003, they overthrew him and said, we are now for democracy. Democracy is important. And that is always the story we hear. We always get the story, we only do this for democracy. We don't do it for profit. We do it for democracy. And here in Europe, we just love to believe that because it sounds good and it sounds ethical and it sounds correct. But if you look at the details, you see that now in Iraq, the oil is being, you know, opened up to foreign investments. Like ExxonMobil can invest, Chevron can invest, Statoil can invest, BP can invest, Shell can invest. Also Chinese and Malaysian companies, Petronas, they can invest, and they're actually buying part of that oil. They couldn't do that when Saddam Hussein was still in power. So it is true what you say. We always have to look at the money flow. We have to look what is the interest of NATO in Europe. And during the Cold War, the interest was, in many ways, also to protect the investments. That is true.
Now I'm going to ask you some questions about Spain. I would like to ask you, what's the background of for Gladio in Spain after the Civil War?
I mean, the case of Spain was very special, because Spain was a dictatorship under Franco. And in a dictatorship, you don't need to manipulate the elections, or you don't need to, you know, fight the communists. I mean, Franco was making sure that there were no communists in the Spanish government. So that was a completely different situation compared to France or Germany or Italy. The question is, what was then the function of Spain? Were there secret armies in Spain as well during the Franco dictatorship? And there we actually have the same problem. We see, yes, there were secret armies, but then Franco and his system, he had so many different units that he could use for illegal operations. He didn't actually need a secret army. So the interesting thing is actually coming in the 1970s when Franco dies and Spain enters NATO in 1982. That's you know, when you really look at Spain in this transition from a dictatorship to a democracy. And there it is interesting to see, how does that very young democracy look at that very difficult chapter of the secret armies? And there we just found out that the military secret service, I think it's called CESID, I'm not sure whether I pronounce it correctly, but the military secret service of Spain, during its time as a democracy, continues to run these secret armies. And when in 1990, the secret armies are being discovered in Italy, Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti, Prime Minister of Italy, says, you know, these secret armies existed also in Spain and in France and in Germany and in Belgium. And the governments in these other countries are very, very, very embarrassed because they didn't want to talk about it. And some people in the Spanish parliament, now that is very good, you know, when you have a democracy, you have people in parliament who ask questions. You didn't have that during the Franco years. But then, in 1990, you have people in the Spanish parliament who ask questions and say, we need more information about these secret armies. The problem was only that Defense Minister Serra, at the time in Spain, said, no, we're not going to talk about this, and we don't know much about it anyway. And all in all, it was not very strong performance. I mean, the democracy was probably too weak. There's no knowledge about the Spanish secret army in the Spanish parliament.
I was very surprised to read in your book that there was a Gladio base in the Canary Islands, in Maspalomas. What said Alberto Bolo, a secret soldier, about the Las Palmas base?
The Las Palmas base is in that way similar to other bases in Italy, that it was an island. You know, when you have the mainland and you have the islands, it is very easy to have something hidden or secret on an island. I mean, it is the same thing in Italy. They had the Centro Addestramento Guastatori, which was CAG, which was the center of the gladiators in Italy. It was on an island. And in Italy and in other countries, the idea was that these islands could also be used to put political prisoners there. So, you know, they served as a twofold thing, as a training camp for the secret armies. But in case of emergency, so we have some sources who say these islands would have been used as prisons.
And what about Escorceni, the Nazi? He lived in Spain until he died. Was he related to Gladio structures?
It is very hard to say what his exactly role was, the role of Escorceni. But we have different right-wing extremists who just move in these networks. I mean, that was one of the questions that, as a historian, I was very surprised to find that we have so many right-wing extremists in the secret armies of NATO. And as you correctly said, at the end of the Second World War, the idea was, we have defeated fascism, we have defeated right-wing extremism, and we don't want right-wing extremists in secret armies. Why would we give them explosives and arms and training and fly them around with the help of the Secret Service? You know, that is something which is completely unthinkable. In some countries, like Norway, we had people who were just people from the center. They were not extremists in any way. I mean, I talked to different secret soldiers in Norway, and they were mainly preoccupied that Norway had been occupied so quickly during the Second World War by the Germans. And they said, we need a second option. We need a secret army. And I have much understanding for that, you know, that some people said, we want a guerrilla, a secret army, but we don't do any terrorism and we are not right-wing extremists, nothing. I also have talked to people in Switzerland, and most people I looked at, they're not right-wing extremists. But some, that is important, some were right-wing extremists, and Escorceni was one of them. And these people, they said, we are in a war anyway, so if we carry out a terrorist attack in Europe, that's okay, because we are at war.
There was a Gladio person, Belgian, André Moyen. Who was this man, and what's his role in Spanish Gladio?
it's not very clear the role of André Moyen, but some people say he was working for the Belgian military secret service, and he set up networks also in Spain, and some other people say, oh no, he never worked for the secret service at all. But what I just collected in my book are all these statements that we have about the stay behind armies in Spain. And what we know from different sources is, yes, there was a secret army in Spain. Yes, it was linked to CIA, MI6, and NATO. And yes, we need more investigation into this. Now, the statements of the people that I mentioned in my chapter on Spain are not the full story. We would actually need much more information, but we only get this information if the Spanish Parliament asks for an investigation. As long as people don't know that there was a secret army, they will not ask for more details on this point of research.
Could you talk about Gladio in the universities of Spain during the 60s?
There is a story that the gladiators were involved in smashing some student movements. That, you know, it is always a question, why do you need gladiators in a dictatorship? That is a question that always comes back. You know, Franco, he could suppress whatever he wanted. He didn't need secret armies. He had secret services and he had the police. And if you're a dictator, you don't actually need secret armies. But it seems, and that is just what I wanted to, you know, put in the book, that right-wing extremists who were active in Italy or who were active in Greece or who were active in France later came to Spain, oppressed the people there, continued in criminal activities, and some of them later went to Bolivia or Chile and continued criminal activities there. So it's more a network, an international network, that nobody dares to talk about.
Can you talk more about this Italian fascist that came after the Borghese coup to Spain?
Delle Chiaie, Stefano Delle Chiaie is one of the Italian right-wing extremists. He was involved in operations in Italy and in Latin America and other countries of Europe. And he's one of these persons who knows a lot about the role of the secret services in these operations, and that's why he's never in front of trial. He never stands in front of a judge. Because he would say, you know, if you accuse me and if you put me into jail, I'm going to talk about NATO and I'm going to talk about the CIA and I'm going to talk about MI6. And these secret services, they were all involved in these operations. So if you blame me, I blame you and we go down together. That's what he says. And in Italy, we had this Borghese coup, which was almost, you know, basically it was a coup d'etat. But people don't realize that in Italy during the Cold War, we had many attempts to overthrow the government. And at that time, in the 60s, the socialists agreed to withdraw from the government. And at later times, they agreed, that is the Aldo Moro affair, not to include the communists in the executive power. So you always had a struggle in Italy on the strength of communists and socialists in the executive branch. That was an intense struggle, and the coup that you mentioned is one of a kind in this struggle power.
What does it mean, quantum? Because they say that it's the name of the gladio in Spain, quantum, red quantum.
It is, you know, if you look at the stay behind armies in all countries of Western Europe, you see that in Switzerland it was called P26, okay? In Italy it was called Gladio. It was discovered in Italy for the first time, so everybody knows the word Gladio. In Greece we have the word red sheepskin. In Spain we have red quantum, a name which surfaced. In Germany, some say it was just called stay behind. So really what you have in Denmark, we have the name Absalon, which surfaced. In Turkey, we had the name Count Guerrilla. So what you really see is that each country had a known history with its secret armies. They had different code names, and it's possible that you have different secret armies in each country. That is possible. It's not to say that everything that happened in Spain was Red Quantum, and Red Quantum was controlled by NATO at all times. The problem really is that NATO doesn't want to talk about it. We need a list from NATO which says who was the commanding general in each country for the secret armies. We need this. I mean, people at least countries who are members of NATO should have the right to know this. Switzerland, as you know, is not a member of NATO. We are part of the Partnership for Peace, which is called, which is a group of countries which just wants to be friends with NATO and have an exchange of information. They don't want to be members of NATO yet, and the Swiss population, they don't want to be in NATO. But I tried to get information from NATO. I sent it to our ambassador in Belgium, and he then handed all my questions to NATO, and NATO just refused to comment. And that is the real problem. The sort of detailed questions that you ask about the name and the network in Spain, they are important. But they need, in order to be answered, they need the cooperation of NATO. And as long as NATO does not publish anything official on the secret armies where they existed, all the names of the people who were involved and the strategic purpose, also the weapons they had and the communication structures they have, we are reliant on the former generals who, you know, before they die, explain what they did in their lives. I mean, that's the data I basically use. General Serravalle explained. He was the general who in Italy operated the Gladio network. He explained how these meetings worked in NATO. NATO never says anything. We just have some people who talk about it. And that's important.
And what kind of terrorist attacks did they committed? And is there any proof that links them to Gladio and NATO? For example, in Montejurra or the Atocha killing of lawyers? And what links them to Stefano delle Chiaie and all these Italian fascists here in Spain?
There are unfortunately no proofs. We don't have, you know, a letter from NATO to the Spanish secret army which says, carry out a terrorist attack, please. We don't have that. There's no such proof. NATO can always say, we have nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And what we do have is we have right-wing extremists in Italy who carried out terrorist attacks. For instance, in 1972, there was the terrorist attack in Peteano. And we have Vincenzo Vinciguerra, who actually carried out this terrorist attack. It is interesting to know that the whole network of NATO secret armies was only discovered because this terrorist attack was investigated in more detail. The story for a long time was that the Peteano terrorist attack in Italy, Peteano is just a small village in northern Italy, that this attack had been carried out by the Brigate Rosse, which were the left-wing terrorist group in Italy. Because after the attack, there had been a phone call, and it was an anonymous phone call, and they said, we are the Brigate Rosse, and we carried out the attack. Okay, fair enough. Everybody believed it, and the police put it out into public. And so the Brigate Rosse were thought to be behind the attack. Later, an investigative journalist in Italy called Felice Casson, he's a judge, not an investigative journalist, and he investigated this terrorist attack. And he found out that it was completely wrong what they tell, that it was not the Brigate Rosse, but it had been right-wing extremists. So to investigate a terrorist attack can take many, many years until you really find out who was behind it. The attack was in 72, and the investigation of that judge were in the 80s. And in 1990, that's 18 years later, that judge forced the Italian prime minister to publicly say that there's a secret army. Okay, if you look at this, then you understand how difficult it is to investigate acts of terrorism. But in this specific case, Vincenzo Vinciguerra confirmed that he had carried out the terrorist attack. He confirmed that there is a NATO secret army, and the prime minister then had to confirm that there's a Gladio secret army in Italy. But in Italy, we had a lot of debate about the secret armies. In Spain, we had next to no debate. So there's not much knowledge about the details about terrorist attacks in Spain. And that is surprising, because Spain, with the ETA, has its own history of terrorism, and it therefore is sensitive to the question of terrorism. So I don't understand why they're so little interested in NATO secret armies.
I want to ask you also, if was Gladio also involved in actions of infiltration in communist and anarchist groups in the countries of Europe? like the Red Brigades, for example, or I don't know if you have information from Spain, but just in Europe in general.
The question of infiltration is an important question, but we don't know for sure whether the Gladio network was involved in infiltration operations. It is possible. We don't have any specific information on that. We know that in Belgium in the 1980s, we had a series of terrorist attacks. They were called the Brabant massacres. That was just a very, very strange chain of events where people, you know, in black overalls would walk into supermarkets and just shoot down people, shoppers, you know. They didn't take much money in the supermarkets. They just killed people who were there with their shopping cars and they just shoot them down. Men, women, children, everybody. And it was terrible. And then the whole population in Belgium was shocked. They were totally shocked. And it seems that the Belgian secret army was involved in this. But when the Belgian Minister of Defense at the time wanted to find out whether the secret army was involved with this, the military secret service refused to cooperate. They refused to hand out the names of the secret army. The Belgian Senate, they made an investigation and said, okay, we need to know who was in these secret armies. We know that the secret armies existed. The Belgian Senate did a very good investigation. They found out that NATO had secret groups, the Allied Clandestine Committee and the Clandestine Planning Committee, and that in these groups, the different representatives of the secret armies met. So there's a lot of knowledge which came out of Belgium, but they couldn't find out who was behind the Brabant massacres. And you must understand that in Belgium, these terrorist attacks, that was in the 1980s, the Brabant massacres, that is something which shocked the population. People want to know what happened. It is very important. And it seems that maybe there were infiltration operations there, using other groups and pretending there was somebody else. But still, there's a lot of work to be done. I can't give you a very clear-cut answer on the question of infiltration.
Thank you. And what about Aginterpress in Lisbon? Mm. Could you talk about that? What was Aginterpress?
Well, Aginterpress, on the surface, you know, when it says press at the end, you would think that is just a publishing house, you know, Cambridge University Press, okay, that everybody thinks what they do is they publish books, maybe some newspapers or journals, but in fact, Aginterpress was something completely different. It was a front organization. A front organization we call a name, or it can even be a little shop, which pretends, you know, that actually this is a press house, and in the back of it, you have a network which does something completely different. Aginterpress was closely linked to the secret armies in Portugal, and the secret armies in Portugal operated also in Spain and in the former colonies of Portugal. So they operated in Africa, and that is also something, you know, which is obviously a very special thing, because in Portugal you also had a dictatorship under Salazar, and that made Portugal another specific case, like Spain. I mean, Spain and Portugal, and also Greece during the time when it was a dictatorship, they obviously are a specific case for the secret armies.
It's very interesting, this point, because in your book you link Aginterpress to an arms factory in a street of Madrid, Calle Pelayo, in the 1977. And that factory, that flat was rented rented by Mariano Sánchez Covisa. He was the chief of the Guerrilleros de Cristo Rey. That was a terrorist group that terrorized people in demonstrations, students demonstrations and so on. So I was very interested when I read that. I was very shocked to see that link, because you say that Aginterpress was linked to the CIA in Lisbon, and then when the dictatorship finished in Portugal, they went to Madrid. And you know, it's a very important point for the investigation in Spain to follow that link.
I mean, that was the idea of the book, you know, to give many researchers the possibility to start their research based on it. I'm not saying that every sentence in the book must be 100% correct. I'm saying I tried to take together the information that I found, and I hope that in Spain and in Portugal and in other countries, there are people who say, hey, wait a moment, I didn't know about this. This is something which needs to be investigated. And I do see that there are people out there who do this work, and I think that is important. When you take your knowledge and add it to my knowledge, then that is how science works. You know, it's like we have building blocks, and somebody knows this, and he describes it, and somebody takes it and thinks about it and says, "Oh, I have something else. I know this." And you know, you now mention something which I didn't know, and that's how knowledge is being built. That is the idea of science. That is the idea of research. The only problem is that this case of research, this sort of research, is very delicate, because we talk about terrorism in Europe, and we don't talk about terrorists, you know, Muslims or just people, you know, far away, and, you know, they're all, we always think, you know, they are responsible for everything. We talk about our own terrorism, in sense, you know, the CIA is, if they're linked to terrorism in Europe, that is a serious question that Europe has with the United States. But I know that, for instance, in Germany, it's very difficult to talk about this, because the Germans want to be very good friends with the United States. And the United States are the biggest economic power of the world, also the biggest military power, and everybody does business with them, so nobody wants a problem with their business. And therefore, it's very difficult to talk about CIA terrorism in Europe. I mean, even in Switzerland, it's difficult to talk about it, but I think, you know, we should be courageous, and we should say, okay, we look at the data, and we don't jump to conclusions, but we look at all the data. We don't only look in one direction, we look at everything.
Yes, it's very shocking, because if you look at the newspapers of those years, in the newspaper you read that, like, if these terrorist groups were uncontrolled fascists, that they were with no link with political power, with no link with NATO, with no link with anything, just people that want to continue with the Franco regime or something like that, that they are uncontrolled people. You know, like when we read nowadays that a skinhead has beaten someone in the street, you know, but you don't link that with any political power, because that would be very shocking. So I think that's what happened in Spain those years.
It's true that we don't link political violence and terrorism with the government. We don't do that. I mean, because we think we pay taxes to the government, okay? That is already hard. Okay, we pay taxes, and the government then looks that the schools are good, that the hospitals are good, that we have roads to drive on, and etc. We can even, you know, have an army which defends us, and there's security, and we have the police which looks after security. So we understand that the government, in all case, helps to provide security. Now, the terrorist is exactly the opposite. He does not create security. He creates instability. He creates fear. He creates chaos. We can't really think that the government, to whom we pay taxes and who is for security, has anything to do with the terrorist who creates insecurity and chaos and fear. But in Italy and in other countries, we find that in some specific cases, criminal elements of the government are linked to this strategy of tension. And that strategy is to create fear in the population, to shock people. But then in the end, you pay your taxes to government, which uses the money to finance terrorists. I mean, that is absolutely unacceptable.
And could you talk about the work of these terrorist fascist groups in Spain against ETA? Because you talk about Stefano Delle Chiai. In your book, we can read that he was also there doing terrorist attacks.
I've had some information on ETA in my book, but really the research on ETA is much bigger than anything that I covered in my book.
Yeah.
What is now, there, you know, people, there are historians in Spain and also journalists in Spain who know much more about ETA. Mm-hmm. I frankly don't know much more about it. I have to say this quite frankly. I really specialized in NATO secret armies. And what is now interesting to see is that we need to have these people who know a lot about ETA to look at the data that is now new on the NATO secret armies and see when were they fighting, what was going on. Is there a new light that we have to shed on terrorism in Spain during the last 50 years, or does it not change the picture? That is just the question that arises. But really,